Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Women's Soccer Zone. A belated Happy New Year to listeners, and thank you very much for once again tuning in as we enter a World Cup year. Plenty to be excited about in the world of women's football. So what do we have for you on the first edition of 2015? So I will apologise in advance. It's a slightly longer edition than I would normally like to put together, but I do have two very in-depth interviews for you. One with Rachel Brown-Finnis, who recently announced her retirement from Everton Ladies, and having amassed over 80 caps for England, I wanted to catch up with her and speak about some of her highlights and some of the difficulties during her career. I also spoke to US Women's National Team striker Kristen Press, who's currently out in California in a US Women's National Team camp getting ready for a couple of high profile international friendlies against France and England. I also spoke to JJ Duke of one of our friends, Our Game magazine, who spoke to me about the upcoming NWSL college draft, which will no doubt be very exciting for fans of the NWSL. So he spoke to me about some of the players to look out for. So an extended edition on this occasion, so hopefully you'll bear with us. So rather than me wasting any more time, let's get cracking.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSOZone.
So usually on this section of the show, we would go through our top five news items, but due to the length of the interviews that we have on this occasion, I'm going to skip that and instead talk primarily about Stephanie Roach and the Puskás Award. This week, we saw the ceremony take place in Switzerland, and unfortunately for Steph, she did lose out to Colombia's James Rodriguez. But as mentioned in the intro, 1.1 million votes, 33% of the vote overall. So something that she should be very, very proud of. And personally, I'd like to thank Steph for really helping to raise the profile of women's football and doing it in such a humble and professional way. So unfortunate for her, but nothing already, as I said, to be ashamed of, and she should be very, very proud. We're going to just very quickly go over to France. We haven't had an update from our friends at Foot d'El for a little while, so the French first division is progressing nicely. So bonjour my friends, why don't you tell me what's going on in the French first division?
Bonjour Kieran, here are the latest news from the French division one. Coupe de France. The French women's football is back with the Coupe de France. The 32 teams qualified for the next round are now known. There is no surprise for the big four D1 clubs, Lyon, Paris, Juvisy and Montpellier, but there is a surprise qualification of Montauban and Caen, winners of the second division. The next matches will take place on January 25th, 2015. D1 Championship. For the first day of Women's Football Championship in 2015, Paris won against Juvisy, Lyon and Montpellier won, Guingamp confirms, Rodez and Soyo snapped. The situation is increasingly difficult for Issy, Metz and Arras. Juvisy Paris. Paris established itself 3-0 at the end of 90 minutes of fierce battle. The Juvisiennes have not managed to shrug them to reverse the score. Once again, it was the international players Lyra Alouchi and Caroline Seguer who marked the game. In this game, Juvisy played one of its last cards for the next Champions League. The score does not quite reflect the reality on the field, because PSG was not always brilliant in its defensive construction. Metz Rodez. Rodez, the first in the non-relegation zone, has struggled to shed the rookie Metz. Both teams were fighting hard, but Metz didn't manage to get the necessary points to stay in the D1. Rodez demonstrates once again the power of its collective play. Coincidence or not, each team was strengthened by the arrival of an American player during the winter transfer window. Soyeux Albi. Scored in the first half, the goal has allowed Soyeux to hold sway over Albi. The score would suggest that the meeting was balanced, yet looking at the statistics, Soyeux was much more offensive than its opponent. For example, Laura Bourgoin missed by the hair the goal of Albi. Montpellier Saint-Étienne. Montpellier was swaying between lack of offensive efficiency and loss of envy, offering one of the surprises this season. On paper, the Montpellier coach has one of the finest groups of the championship. At the same time, Saint-Étienne, who announced its intention to set up a real sports project at the height of its ambitions, failed to take over despite a comeback before the break. Guingamp-Arras. Guingamp confirms its outsider status of the ranking, beating Arras, Red Lantern of the current season. The players of Sarah and Barek keep ahead of Montpellier and occupy the fourth place in the rank. Guingamp is now very close to Juvisy. Arras will have it hard to reverse the situation, remaining on the mass spot. Issy Lyon. Winning against Lyon was an impossible mission for the Owls of Issy. Very quickly, the serial scorers of Lyon scored 9 goals. As Issy sinks into the red zone, Olympique Lyonnais continues its double race, the championship and the Coupe de France. Looking backwards, there are many contenders looking for the slightest mishap, and every victory for Olympique Lyonnais is way ahead into the safety zone.
Merci to Footdel, our friends out in France. Now, normally, as I said, we would do a little bit of a news roundup, but I can promise you that we will focus on that in the next episode. The Women's Super League in England has been particularly busy with transfers between clubs happening over the last week or two. But I think, speaking about the FAWSL, this is a good time to go into our first interview. And I managed to catch up with Rachel Brown-Finnis, the former Everton ladies and England goalkeeper who announced her retirement in the last couple of weeks. And I wanted to have a chat with her about her career, the highs and lows, and of course, representing her country. So here she is. Okay, so I'm delighted to be joined on the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone by Rachel Brown-Finnis, who recently announced that she was retiring. Rachel, what is it that's made you come to the decision at this time, aged 34, with Everton Ladies, and you've decided to call it a day? Why now?
Well, I've kind of mulled it over for the last couple of months since the end of the Everton season last year, and basically I've been having sort of chronic problems. I've had 5 operations on my left knee, 1 on my right knee. I've had some back problems over the last couple of years, so it was really down to my body sort of not packing in, but thinking about the long term effects of football. Emotionally and mentally I've still got it, but physically it was time to hang the gloves up.
How difficult did you find last season based on that? I think I read in your kind of departing interview on the Everton website that injuries had played a big part. How much did you have to kind of struggle through last year?
Well, I did, and Everton were fantastic in that they let me and helped me modify my training so that, you know, I couldn't have physically trained every single day. But I did some form of training every day, but you know, offload and not necessarily do goalkeeper training every day, because obviously there's a lot of hitting the ground, a lot of impact on your body. That's kind of similar for a lot of, you know, more senior players who've been throwing themselves on the ground for 20 odd years. It takes its toll. But ultimately, with that modification, I didn't miss a game last season because of injury. So, you know, I was able to get ready for all the games last season, and I was actually quite pleased with how I played, sort of my contribution to the team, even though we did end up getting relegated. But I enjoyed last season the majority of the time. But knowing how I felt after every goalkeeper session and the amount of time it took me to recover from the impact of those really kind of has made me think twice as to what it's doing to my body long term. Which ultimately is why I've made the big decision to step away from the playing side of football for now.
Did Everton's relegation have any influence on your decision? If the club had stayed in the division, would you have tried to maybe give it another year?
No, it had no impact whatsoever. My decision was I was already making the decision even halfway through last season, not even just this most recent season, but season in 2013, I was considering my future because of the physical element of it. So no, relegation really didn't play a part, and as a goalkeeper you end up having more to do, which is quite enjoyable in a team that, you know, is maybe not playing to its full capacity. And on reflection of last season, we started the first half of the season, we had a great time and we played some good football. But, you know, whatever happened the second half of the season, we got relegated, but yeah, it didn't have any sort of any weighting at all on my decision.
In all the time that you've played at Everton, ladies, you played in the top division of English football. How difficult, you said you enjoyed it, but how difficult was it from your perspective, having been there for so long, seeing the club kind of struggle a little bit at the bottom of the table and end up being relegated?
I think that probably was a difficult thing for any player who'd been there for quite a long time. And there's quite a number of us who have been at Everton for a good number of years, to see the club maybe not progress at the rate that we knew it needed to, or we knew that rival teams in the area were progressing at. We kind of, you know, knew that potentially could get left behind. I think we were just hoping that the consequence maybe wouldn't come about this season, and, you know, would get relegated so early on. But on reflection, it's potentially the reality check that as a club, we maybe have actually needed to instill change. And hearing about some of the meetings that have been had at Everton between the ladies' side of the club and the actual club, I'm very positive about the future of Everton ladies.
Well, it would be easy to dwell on negatives based on the fact the club got relegated, but you are going to be staying there as an ambassador for Everton ladies. You'll be the first ambassador for the club. And looking at the squad that was put together last year and that will continue on, there's some promising young players there, isn't there? There's a lot to be positive about. The likes of Gabby George came through last year, and players like her will be influential and really important moving forward, won't they?
Absolutely, they will. You know, some of the younger players, as you said, stepped up probably earlier than they expected to have to last season. But I think the focus of us consolidating in WSL2 is to not lose any more players, to ensure that we have an infrastructure at the club that excites players, that enables players to see a future at the club, even if they are top international senior players. So yes, you know, next season will be in WSL2. We hope that that is a brief stay, but that's not going to be an easy task in itself. And for young players, like you mentioned, Gabby, George, and Millie Turner as well, who both came over from Man United's Academy Centre of Excellence, that they can see future at Everton. I think that's the most important thing, and one thing that, in my role as an ambassador at Everton, I'll be looking to try and aid with that in any way that I can do, so that people coming to Everton ladies know that we are on the up, which, you know, I think, if we're being honest, has maybe not been the case in the last few years, as I've mentioned, in comparison to teams that have gone semi-professional and fully professional. But now I'd like to think we're in a place where, you know, Everton ladies has got a very positive future.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, look, we've talked a lot about the club, but the purpose of this interview is to talk about you a little bit more. Looking back at your 12 years, what would you say was the main highlight? I mean, I'm going to assume that the FA Cup win over Arsenal at the City Ground would be up there, but tell me what your highlight was as an Everton player.
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely the highlight. You know, that was a culmination of so many years of hard work, of having an exceptional group of players, young players, as well as older seniors that have been there a long time. So that's definitely the proudest moment for me as an Everton player, and for that group of girls. Because we worked so hard, you know, we were the underdogs, even getting to the final. So I would say the FA Cup final win is definitely a highlight. But it's been on a journey, you know, we've won League Cups. We came so close to winning the league, losing on the last day of the season. We've gone off to far-flung Eastern European countries to play in the Champions League, which has, you know, been an adventure and a real taste of top-flight football. So, more than anything, it's been a real journey, and you know, something that I'm proud to have been a part of. You know, I just hope that the roller coaster that is football, we get back on the upslopes as soon as possible.
When you saw players leaving, you obviously won the FA Cup in the late 2000s, and then you enter the FA WSL, you have a good first season in the WSL, and then players start to look for other challenges. We obviously saw Farrah Williams and Tash Dowie move over to Liverpool. Tony Duggan went over to Manchester City. Were you ever offered the opportunity to play elsewhere, and was there ever a temptation to maybe take on another challenge at another club?
To be honest, I didn't get any direct contact from anyone about full-time playing opportunities. Might as well be honest about that. I mean, I could have pursued to go elsewhere, but I've kind of wanted to stay loyal to Everton. I worked for the club for 6.5 years in the community department and made some really good friends there. I couldn't really see myself playing anywhere else. You know, I'd become a Blue and really kind of loved my time there. So for better or for worse, it kind of felt for me really that, you know, I was going to stay at the club.
Okay.
So I understand completely why the likes of Farrah, who had a long time left in a playing career, Tony Duggan, Jill Scott, Tash Dowie, Lucy Bronze, you know, the list is quite long, unfortunately, of players that we've lost to clubs in the area. But, you know, Man City and Liverpool are both offering full-time playing positions, and as a young footballer, male or female, who's going to turn down the opportunity to go and play professionally somewhere? And I think, you know, that's kind of what Everton are competing against, really. Our clubs in our area offering those terms. No, they're not mega money, but it does mean that you don't have to do anything other than play football. Mm. And you're in there every day, and you're part of the club on a day-to-day basis, which, you know, I think women's football has come so far because, you know, even 2 years ago, that wasn't in place. So I can understand why players have left, but I'm, you know, I'm proud to have spent my career at Everton and to finish up here.
Well, as well as Everton, 83 caps for England, I think I read, which is a phenomenal return when you think about the keepers that you've been up against over the years. What would you say was the highlight for you when representing your country?
I would definitely say the Olympics was a highlight. No doubt. I think if you speak to anyone who was involved at the Olympics, they will probably give you the same answer. And it was obviously partly to do with the play-in and the crowds that we drew, you know, memorable crowd at Wembley in front of 70,000 people against Brazil. But actually being part of a multi-sports tournament, being part of the Olympics, which growing up watching every single sport possible in the Olympics, and so thinking how wonderful it would be to go and watch it. It would have been, you know, if I hadn't have been selected for the squad, I no doubt would 100% would have gone and watched the Olympics, because I've always been a massive fanatic of it. But to have to be privy to kind of that inside kind of view to it all, and live in the Olympic Village and see how Olympians live, and to actually have been awarded the honour of becoming an Olympian myself, that is definitely why it makes that so special. So the Olympics, I would say, is definitely my highlight of my career, and certain even one of the highlights of my life.
I've spoken to a few players that were involved in that Olympic squad, and they pretty much say the same thing, but they also say that there are some regrets there, that maybe Team GB didn't fulfil their potential. You look at the squad that they had, and it was very, very talented. But being knocked out by Canada in the quarterfinals, I think it was, off the top of my head. Do you look back on it and think, do you know what, we really should have medalled in that tournament?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo what they've said, and we're massively disappointed with getting knocked out at that stage, and I think more so with the fact that we were pretty pants on the night, and, you know, losing the game in a pretty lacklustre performance made it even harder to take that we've been knocked out in that manner. Canada are a really good team, you know, we took USA right to the wire in the next round. But we didn't do our self-justice on that evening. I mean, there's always, I think when you don't get the result that you want, you always obviously analyse why that happened. But, you know, in time, you can reflect on it, and overall, as an Olympics, I can only reflect on it positively, other than, you know, that result. But the overwhelming sort of feeling is very positive towards the whole experience of the Olympics.
Okay, so a very nice highlight, and one that I'm sure won't be forgotten anytime soon. A low light, I'm sure, I remember watching it on the television. It was a World Cup qualifying playoff away in Switzerland. You were red carded in that game, weren't you, Rachel? Now, for anyone that didn't see that game, explain to me why you were sent off. I know why, but why did you get sent off?
Well, the ref said that I had pulled the girl's hair, which sounds, you know, could only happen in women's football. But what happened, they scored. I went to get the ball out of the back of the net. Then Backman, who is their sort of star centre forward, came running into the back of the net to try and get the ball. As I bent down, she seemed to hold her face and throw herself on the ground, and claimed I'd elbowed her in the face. So what the ref saw, I have no idea. She apparently pardoned me for pulling the girl's hair while she was holding her face, and I was in what the hell had gone on, really. So it was quite comical, to be honest, on reflection, seeing it that evening after, thankfully, we'd won the game and you know, made it through. It really was quite comical to see the replay and see how ridiculous it was. Thankfully, that red card didn't have any consequence. We qualified. It got rescinded, and we all had a big laugh about it. And eventually, Backman sent a message of apology to me. So I can't say I've been in touch with her since.
Well, she's gone on to become a very, very important player for her country and for her club out in Sweden. Any other kind of highlights or any memories that you have, Rachel, that you'd like to share with listeners?
Oh, I mean, loads. We the first time we qualified for a World Cup was unbelievable. I mean, that's second to the highlight of playing in the Olympics. We're away in France. All of our families were there. My husband-to-be was there. My mum, my dad, my brother, my auntie, my uncle. And the same for pretty much everyone. I think we needed to go to France and get a draw. Was the result that we needed, and we went out there, and gosh, it was a hard slog. You know, it was at 93rd minute, 94th minute, 95th minute, and when that final whistle went, and I think we'd drawn 1-1, but then we'd qualified for the first ever World Cup under the FA. It was just, you know, untold joy, really, because we'd not none of that group had ever qualified for a World Cup. You know, now it's kind of taken for granted that we qualify for the World Cup, because that's the standard that we have now. But back in, I think it was 2006, you know, that was something that wasn't a given, that we would be in World Cups. So to have been that part of that first team that did qualify for the World Cup, that was an unbelievable evening. Good night afterwards as well, because like I said, all our families were there. We had a great time celebrating the fact.
And obviously got to go out to China in 2007, and people will remember Kelly Smith with the gold boots. I know she got told off by Hope Powell for taking
everyone
it. Taking
told off by Hope Powell, so take that with a pinch of salt. yeah, I mean, Kelly's been England's best player, no doubt, ever. You know, and still in the frame now for England for the World Cup this summer. Very special talent. And someone who I've grown up sort of admiring as a teammate, fortunately. That was brilliant. China in itself was an amazing experience. None of us have been that far away, you know, to a tournament, to anywhere really before. So going to China again, a lot of friends and family took the opportunity to come out there, because it was somewhere you're not going to go to normally, you know, unless there's a reason to go. So. Yeah, again, lots of friends and family, being in Shanghai for 2 weeks. The 2 weeks leading up to it, we went to Macau, which was an Olympic training base ahead of Beijing. And so we stayed there and sort of mingled with a few British athletes who were actually out there at the time. So some brilliant memories from football. I mean, I've been involved for so long that, you know, it's been more than half my life that I've spent playing for England. And so it's going to have had a big impact on what I've seen, what I've done, who I've met, everything really, my character. Football shaped a lot of that. So I've so many things to kind of be thankful and grateful for and to really kind of appreciate. And also to be proud of, like you mentioned right at the beginning. So, so many memories and so many people who've been a part of that have all made it such an amazing time that, like I said, has shaped who I am and hopefully will continue to do so moving forward, staying in the part of football.
Well, I think that's a lovely way to finish the interview with such humble words. Rachel, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. Enjoy the retirement, but also we're not going to see the last of you in women's football. Obviously, we already mentioned you are going to be the first ambassador for Everton Ladies. So enjoy that role and, of course, enjoy whatever you do for the rest of the future.
Thank you very much. Like I said, whether it be on the TV or whether it be working for Everton, I want to stay involved in football and continue to be an ambassador, whether it's in a formal or informal capacity.
Women's Soccer Zone would like to thank our partners, She Kicks Magazine. Subscribe at shekicks.net for even more women's football.
So big thanks there to Rachel. We wish her well in her future endeavours, and only one of a handful of British women's footballers who can call themselves an Olympian. Now, before we go into our interview with Kristen Press, I caught up with Our Game magazine's JJ Duke, who gave a very comprehensive preview of the upcoming NWSL college draft. So here he is talking to me about that draft and some of the players that we should be looking out for. So here he is.
Okay, so I'm delighted to be joined by one of the editors of one of our friends at Our Game magazine, JJ Duke, who has been on the show previously, and he is going to have a chat with us about the upcoming NWSL draft. Lots of interest in some of the players coming out of college. So, JJ, how you doing, mate?
Yeah, Kieran, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, always a pleasure. So, you know an awful lot more about the college system and the draft system than I do. Obviously, it's alien to us over here in England. We don't get an awful lot of access to the college game. So I guess my first question would be, how strong is this draft class that will be entering the NWSL in 2015?
Well, you know, as compared to the two previous drafts, I think this is probably the deepest, in the sense that you look down some of the names that you have. Obviously, you have former youth internationals, you have former full team and current, I shouldn't say former, current full team internationals as well. But, you know, even then, after that, you have a lot of players that, you know, could be fighting for spots down the road. And, you know, they'd be playing in the U23 camp that's going on right now, and potentially in that U23 camp team that will play in a couple of months in the tournaments that they participate in. So, you know, there's a lot of players that teams are going to keep an eye on. I think the most exciting prospect about this draft, Kieran, is the fact that these players are going to get drafted in, are going to be competing for first team minutes right off the bat. And obviously with the big reason for that with the World Cup.
Yeah, of course. And I think you're going to be putting together a draft preview for Our Game magazine's website. Now, this may well have gone up by the time this interview comes out, so I apologize if people have read this already. But looking at it, you have mentioned the fact that not only is this draft class maybe the strongest that we've seen, but also when you look at some of the players that have been drafted over the first 2 years, especially the forwards, they've not necessarily had the game time that they may well have liked, have they?
No, I mean, yeah, it's funny, because in the college game, you don't often see teams, they're getting better at it, albeit, but a lot of the times it's play the ball wide and try to pump it into the box as much as possible, or lump it over the top and let your fastest players, which is often enough your forwards, get onto it and score. You know, we've had some very quality forwards come through the college game. However, in the pro game, it's a lot more physical, and I know players have always talked about it, that every regular season match is almost like playing a World Cup quarterfinal or semifinal, that in the sense that it's so physical, and you have to basically fight for any time that you get on the pitch, and once you get on the pitch, you have to, you know, go into full protect mode, but then attack the game. So when these younger forwards are going against more experienced defenders, the end product, or the return on investment teams are trying to get, and you'll probably hear me say that a lot throughout this interview, teams are obviously looking to try and, you know, get some production from the players that they drafted, and the forwards, for the most part, haven't really translated. But then again, you have a couple of stories in previous years in the later rounds. For those who don't know, the NWSL draft is 4 rounds, 9 picks per round. Traditionally, every team has a pick, but through trades and whatnot, there'll be some teams that have more than one pick, some that have less than one pick. But in those later rounds, you might be able to find, you know, what we call a diamond in the rough, or someone that might have been off the board a little bit, off the radar, but can come through and produce.
And I guess one of those from last year, although she's now retired, would be Jasmine Reeves of the Boston Breakers. She was picked in the later rounds and obviously scored quite a few goals for the Breakers. Now, you mentioned how deep this group is, and names that spring to mind for me that I will recognise, not having had much access to the college game, is the likes of Morgan Bryan, who many will expect to be the first round pick or the number one pick in the first round, Sam Mewis, Sarah Killian, who have both been involved with the US women's national team. But what other players across the board stand out for you, and who do you think are going to be able to make a real impact in the NWSL?
Well, what position do you want to start?
Well, I mean, shall we start from the back? I mean, you've the preview that I've seen, you've named 6 goalkeepers. So, I mean, out of those, who would you say is the one that's most likely to make an impact?
Well, you know, goalkeepers, it's interesting because, especially with this year, nearly every team is going to be down one goalkeeper in the NWSL. So all these, you know, players that I think have a good chance of being drafted will have a chance to fight for minutes. Then again, you have to take into account the internationals. In like many other leagues, you're not going to get a whole lot of internationals because there's roster restrictions. So I'll start off with Caitlin Rowland, a graduate out of UCLA, who's a member of the U-20s for the USA this past summer. And she currently, you know, finished up her collegiate career, one of the most well-accomplished in the net, holds NCAA records for clean sheets, 19 in one season, and also 54 in her careers, and with a very minuscule goals against average. So you have to look at her to be potentially a player that would be seeing some good first team minutes.
Okay, so we'll move on to defenders. But actually, before we talk about the ones that are going to be entering the draft, it's been confirmed today that one of those that maybe will have entered the draft have actually signed for Liverpool Ladies. Do you want to give us a bit of information about her?
Yeah, so Satara Murray joining Liverpool. We knew about this for a little bit of time. Obviously, it was officially confirmed today, but through the powers of social media, we found out a few weeks ago that she will be heading over to England. And I hope that all the listeners from the UK will enjoy her game, because she's a very powerful defender, but very technical at the same time. So she's definitely going to be someone that will be enjoyed playing for Liverpool.
And how about your standout defender that is actually going to be in the draft? Who's going to make an impression?
Well, it's really a toss of a few. Abby Dahlkemper, another one of these talented UCLA players. For those who don't know, UCLA won the whole thing back in 2013. Very strong team. They are graduating almost their entire back line. So that's going to be something that will be need to dealt with by Amanda Cromwell, the head coach of UCLA, in due time. But Dahlkemper is another solid player. Erin Gilliland from Kentucky, she was a forward, but then turned defender. But if you look at her statistics, it didn't even really register. You'd look at it, she had 7 goals and 8 assists in 23 matches, a second-team All-American, and the first Kentucky player to ever get as high as that in the All-America listings. And, you know, she could be another one of those players that not only saw defender, but, you know, when even that emergency situation playing up front, she could do the job. So really one of those two, I think, will be standouts this season.
Move on to the midfielders, and this is arguably the strongest group out of the four that we're going to talk about. We've already mentioned the likes of Morgan Brying, Sam Mewis, and Sarah Killian. Is there one other that you'd pick out?
Someone that I've enjoyed seeing her stock rise over the past couple of years, keep an eye out for Danielle Colaprico. In the past couple of seasons, this outside midfielder has just been knocking in great service after great service. She had, on this season, 19 assists in 26 games. She, a key fixture for 4 years at the University of Virginia. She was the ACC, the Atlantic Coast Conference Midfielder of the Year, second team All-American, from the state of New Jersey, which is a very rabid soccer state. So currently having her on my board at the moment, at the number six spot. However, looking at the picks, and I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, who's slotted where later on in this episode, but there's a strong possibility that I might see Colaprico's name be on the board when Sky Blue, the New Jersey-based NWSL club, picks in the second round.
Brilliant. Well, we've spoken a lot about the midfielders. We know about the US players already. I don't think we need to discuss those. So let's move on to the forwards. What do you make of those?
You know, as we already mentioned, there's a little bit of a disconnect between goal production from the collegiate game to the pro game. It just, again, the physicality just takes another step up when you get into the NWSL. So, you know, there's a lot of different players that I think in the forward group that can, you know, really flex between a midfield and a forward role. One of those being Kelly Minot out of Texas A&M. You know, big surprise with the Aggies making the College Cup, which is the tournament in the NCAA for the last four teams in the NCAA tournament. She had 18 goals, 10 assists in 27 games. She's fifth in program history, scoring over 50 goals, which is quite an amazing achievement. But then she can also flex and play in the midfield. So, you know, I'm a little curious to see how many forwards go from this draft, and of that group, how many get dropped back into the midfield with their respective club teams.
Okay, very, very appreciative of your in-depth look at some of those players, JJ. Mm-hmm. We'll have a look at some of the teams. We're not going to go through all of them, but looking at your piece, the thing that immediately leaps out to me is the fact that the Western New York Flash have four first-round picks. Now, that is nearly half of the entire first round. Now,
yep.
We know last year that trades are made on the day. There are players moving left, right and centre in exchange for draft picks. Do you think the Western New York Flash will use all those four, or they will try and trade some of those picks to get in some players?
You know, it's one of those things that, like you said, if you have that many picks in a specific round, why hold on to them? Western New York will not be trading any of those picks. I can almost give you 100% guarantee with that. And a big reason of that is the acquisition of bringing in Charlie Nemo as a consultant and also technical advisor with the Western New York Flash. Now, for those who don't know his story, he was the head coach for the Pally Blues. Now, that's a pro-am team or a summer league team here in the States. They compete in the W League, or I should say did compete in the USL W League until the club decided to suspend operations. But Nemo is on board with the Flash. A lot of the top prospects played for Nemo with the Pally Blues. This is a club, you know, for ones that are wondering, well, how is that possible? These are really kind of summer teams for us that allow collegiate players and players that have moved on from the college game but still want to play competitive soccer. They are not professionals. However, there are specific teams that can elect to run as a professional operation. Long story short, it's a league that, you know, NCAA players can go play in during the summer without having to deal with the restrictions that the NCAA puts down. But Nemo has coached a lot of these players that are in the draft in one form or another, and I wouldn't be surprised to see a few of his former players be taking a plane flight to Rochester, New York once the season starts.
Now, Boston Breakers finished second bottom in the league, and we would expect that they would have a lot of work to do, having lost the likes of Heather O'Reilly and Leanne Sanderson. They have the number 9 pick in the first round. What are we expecting from them? Because I would argue that they've probably got the most work to do to try and rebuild that squad, haven't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, the club has already put in a good amount of work during the off season. As I bring up their current roster, the most notably of their moves is they've brought in 3 Brazilian players to, you know, kind of up the tempo a little bit. Some of those players being Andres Alves. You know, that's a player that recently featured with the national team down in that 4-team tournament in Brasilia. Franciele is another player that was brought in, formerly played with Sky Blue back in the old WPS. They've also made trades to bring in Cassie Coleman and Morgan Marlborough from FC Kansas City. So, you know, they've already done a good amount of work in the offseason to stack their roster, but I don't know, I agree, they're going to need to make some big moves in this draft. Boston has a pretty solid pedigree when it comes to picking players. Like we already talked about earlier on the show, Jasmine Reeves was a late-round draft pick and had 7 goals in 17 matches. Molly Pathman, another one of those players that was a key standout. There's a lot of things that they need to fill at all positions outside of goalkeeping at the moment. Defense, one, and potentially a goal scorer. But as we said, you never know what you're going to get from the forwards. But I wouldn't be surprised if Lee Billiard and company really have a good draft this year as they've done the past two.
Chicago Red Stars last year had 2 first-round picks. One of those was Julie Johnston. They have 2 first-round picks again. They're in a decent position because of that, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And, you know, Chicago, out of the 9 teams, they have had the best drafting of all of them, in the sense that all 8 of their draft picks that they've picked in the last 2 years have not only stayed with the club, but they have produced. You know, obviously, Julie Johnson and also Vanessa DiBernardo from last year started nearly every match that they're available for. Jen Hoy was a surprise pick down the 4th round in 2013, a player from Princeton University, who elected to start her pro career halfway through 2013 because she was going to finish up her degree. And, you know, she produced good talent up front, lots of speed there, and also played a little bit with the U23s for the U.S. So they've had good luck thus far. 2 first-round picks. You'll be curious to see how Rory Dames decides to go about it. He's another coach that really enjoys the drafting process. So, you know, who's going to be available? Again, not really sure, because what Western New York Flash does, and also if Dagny Brynjar's daughter elects to go to the draft, will dictate really the pace of that first round.
I'm interested by the kind of tactics and approach to the draft that teams have. We've already mentioned the fact that Western New York Flash have 4 first-round picks, Chicago have 2. At the time of recording, there is a very good chance we're expecting Portland Thorns to make a trade that could see them go into the draft with no picks. In other words, they might as well not even turn up. The Seattle Reign don't have a first-round pick, and Washington Spirit have 1 pick, which is the number 30 pick. It's interesting to kind of see the different approaches that teams take. Why do you think there are some teams that are more keen on the draft and certainly than others appear to be? And obviously this year there is going to be an additional international place available to teams as well. Do you then foresee those 3 teams that I've just mentioned maybe going more for the international experience than the draft players in the college system?
Well, I mean, it would serve to say, especially for the Washington Spirit, that they've brought in an international influence to that team. There's without question, especially now with the current head coach, Mark Parsons. He's brought in a couple players, most notably Tosh Harding from the offseason, who you guys have gotten fairly familiar with. But, you know, Washington is also, they've done fairly well in the draft. They had Crystal Dunn last year as the number one pick. They're going to get some players back from injury who were either drafted previously or injured and now set to come back. And that was a result of getting those players via trade from the draft. So, you know, it's tough. Teams definitely do prefer having drafted players versus trading those picks to get either more veteran players or international players, what have it be. But again, this year it's really a who knows what's going to happen, because with the draft, or excuse me, with the Women's World Cup halfway through the season, you already know that we're not going to see a whole lot of the U.S. players. For the Canadian players, you know, it's still, again, up in the air, but it's to my understanding at this point that we won't see them at all till after the Women's World Cup's over. And there's only a handful of Mexican players still in the league. There's a handful of Australian players. We don't know really what their status is going to be. Again, things could change between the time of recording and when the show comes out. So it's tough, but to go along with what you're asking, teams do value picking those international players a little more, or established veterans, versus going with the young raw talent out of the collegiate system. But you know, it just might be with the amount of trades that they made in the past that they don't really have anything to work with. But then again, they might show up and be looking to make some moves, so you never know.
Well, a very in-depth look, JJ. I really appreciate your time. What I think I might do is, I know the draft is coming up and I know that you're going to be in attendance, and what we'll probably do is we'll get yourself and we'll get our old friend Sarah Gerke on as well, and we'll have a little review of how each team fared when the draft has actually taken place. So thank you very much for your time, and enjoy the draft, because I'm sure it's going to be an interesting day.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
So big thanks there to JJ for that in-depth look at the NWSL draft, and I will get him back after the draft has taken place in the next edition to review the picks that have been made by the 9 NWSL clubs. And speaking of the NWSL, that brings us nicely on to our final interview for this episode of the show. And as mentioned in the intro, it is with Chicago Red Stars and US Women's National Team striker Kristen Press, someone that I've wanted to get on the show for quite some time. So she spoke to me while out on the US Women's National Team camp in California, talking about her 2014 and her hopes and aspirations for the upcoming year. So here she is.
So I'm delighted to be joined on this episode of Women's Soccer Zone by Kristen Press. Privileged to be joined by Kristen Press, actually, someone that I've wanted to get on for a little while. Kristen, you're currently out in California in a training camp that's around 3 weeks. How is it all going out there?
We are 1 week into a long 3 week camp, but it's been going really well. I think this is an opportunity for the team to kind of dig in a little bit and get our base fitness up and start to mesh together as a team. It's, of course, a really important year for us, and I think that we're all enjoying being together and putting in the work.
How beneficial are these camps for players? In a World Cup year especially, is this a case of the more time the team and the squad spends together, the more beneficial it's going to be as that Canada tournament approaches?
Absolutely. I think that the more that we play together and understand each other, the better the chance we have this summer. And that's the unique part about a national team versus a club team, is you don't have as many training sessions and as many lunches together when players are dispersed throughout the country. So these long training camps are those opportunities to come together on and off the pitch.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about 2015 and a little trip over to England that you're going to be making in the next few weeks. But I do want to look back a little bit, just briefly, at your 2014, because it was, I think it would be fair to say, an up and down one for you on a personal level, not because of the performances that you were putting in, but the events that unfolded in Sweden with Tyresö. So now, a colleague of mine, Linda Eriksson, interviewed you after your last game for Tyresö, and I think you described it as bittersweet when you were leaving, because you won your last game, but obviously it was the last game that you were ever going to play for the club. You grew very attached to Sweden. How difficult was it to leave, and do you hope at some point in the future that you could possibly go back?
It was incredibly difficult for me to leave. I think that my 2.5 years in Sweden, I really refound my passion for soccer, and so because of that, I have a huge attachment to it, and I have a lot of respect for the league there and for the quality of football that a lot of the teams are playing, because it kind of educated me on the kind of player that I wanted to be and what I wanted to do on a team, what roles I could play. And I grew so much and learned so much out there that it was really hard to leave. Part of me still felt like my time wasn't over abroad. And of course, it was a really emotional experience fighting for Champions League three different times. And my last run, we got to the finals and lost, obviously. So it was hugely emotional and heartbreaking to leave, and to leave on that note with my team disbanding because of financial problems, having lost in the finals of Champions League and in the middle of the season. It was very tumultuous, I would say, but those kind of experiences build you up as a player and make you stronger. And I know that 100% I am stronger and a better athlete because of it.
I interviewed your teammate from Tirso, Veronica Buchetti, just before Christmas, and she described that Tirso side as a dream team. Obviously some really talented players around you, the likes of Vero and Marta. That Champions League final, I know you were on the receiving end of a very narrow defeat to Wolfsburg, but how much fun was it playing in that game?
Oh, it was such a great game. It was exciting. It was emotional. We had the run of play, and we were playing really well. And I think there's something special about a final, and a lot of the times you never get an ideal performance out of either side because the pressure and the build-up and the nerves that are involved. But in that particular final, we kind of let loose. Both sides did, and everything happened. And you know, there was two phenomenal offenses going against each other and just breaking the other team down. And I haven't watched it back, but I can imagine that it was a really entertaining game to watch, and it was a phenomenal game to be a part of.
Can I recommend you do watch it back? Because I think from a fan's perspective and a media perspective, that was arguably without doubt the best game in any competition last year, I think, in the whole of 2014. So I know it will hurt. I know it will hurt that you're on the receiving end of the wrong result.
I can watch the first half.
Watch the first 45 minutes if I were you, because you were very, very impressive in the first 45. I don't want to dwell too much on Tirso because obviously it was a little while back now, but you ended up in the NWSL. I think I looked at your record with Chicago, averaging a goal every other game, so you adjusted very quickly. Your stint with the US Women's National Team, as I mentioned before we came onto this recording, you played in virtually every, well, you did play or featured in every game for the US Women's National Team last year. Granted, some of those will have been substitute appearances. From a personal perspective, how much did it feel like a bit of a breakout year for you for the national team because you featured so regularly?
Yeah, I think that it was actually kind of a tumultuous year for me on the national team as well, with the changing of the guard when our head coach shifted, and sort of kind of repositioning myself and finding a new position and trying to find out where I fit in and what system we're going to be playing in. But when I look back on it and I hear that and I see that, I grew a lot, and I was in a position that I was definitely not in the previous year, where I knew if it was game day, I was going to play. I didn't know how much or what position or what I was doing, but I always felt that confidence that I was going to step on the field, and that's a really nice thing as a player. It's hard to prepare for a game when you don't know if you'll feature in it at all. So I think that that helped me a lot, and it allowed me to, when I was on the field, to be very focused and driven and trying to push forward. And in the end, this year was about me trying to fight for a starting position on the team, and I'm going to have to continue that battle throughout probably my career on the national team. So I think looking back, it was a good year. A really good year, and I think that the experiences that I had with the national team taught me a lot.
How much are you enjoying that competition? That forward line is, I would say, without question, the most fearsome in the world. You've got Sid LaRue, yourself, Abby, Alex Morgan, Amy Rodriguez. The list is endless. There's probably players knocking on the door who will be looking to try and get a final position before the World Cup. How much competition is there in camp, and how much are you enjoying that tussle that you're having with them?
I think that there's two sides. First, it's really difficult because you can never catch breath. There's always people right on you, right behind you, right in front of you. So it's intense, I think is the word I would use to describe it. And it's difficult because with a lot of prominent players in our attacking line, we rotate a lot. And it's harder to get that familiarity with your second forward or in a three front. It's harder to get that familiarity when you have so many players that could be playing in the positions and you might be shifting positions and doing that. But on the other end of it, it's phenomenal to have such competition. And in different teams, you might have more of that comfort or that stability, but that doesn't push you to your limit every single practice. And here I feel like every time I step on the field, it's a tryout and I have to be focused every second of the practice and give all of myself to the game, or else someone will have that spot and I'll be watching them.
That was going to be my next question, actually. How much are you having to almost adapt to different positions and almost gain a versatility into your game? We've seen Jill Ellis more so probably than Pierre and Tom previously shifting players around. We've seen the likes of Lauren Holiday adopt a defensive midfield role. We've seen you play probably in all three positions across the front line. How much are you learning and having to develop your game to ensure that you have that versatility so that when you are called upon, whatever position you play, you are going to be ready to fill that void?
I think that would be the most prominent memory that I have from the last 6 months as a soccer player is adapting. I never had a position on a team where, we need a center mid, she'll play center mid. I was never that versatile player. I was always a center forward. I've trained there my whole life, and I'm very comfortable there. So when Jill took over as coach and she saw me as a player that can fill in any role and learn the different positions, I think I had to embrace that, and I have, and I think that it's an incredible learning opportunity for me, regardless of where I end up. Having played in several attacking positions, it allows me to understand my teammates better and their positioning and their mindset from the wing, from a center position, maybe from an attacking center mid position. I think it's really good for players to understand the other roles and not to be able to rely on the same things. I have a few tricks that as a center forward, I can just always pull them out because those are like my go-to tools. But when I'm on the wing, it's a whole different set of responsibilities and angles that I have to adapt and change. And I think it's forced me to get out of my comfort zone a lot.
How much pressure do you feel as a member of this team? We see supporters on social media, they're quite vocal, the US fans, compared to a lot of the supporters that I follow and speak to. There is a lot of expectation on this team because of the talent that it has. How much pressure do you as a player and a member of this team feel, or do you try and block that out and just focus on what you have to do?
I think that if you asked different players on our team, everyone would have a different perspective on that. This being my first world championship, or the first opportunity that I have to be in a world championship, that comes with a whole other set of pressure. But I don't feel the history of having lost in a final last year that a lot of my teammates have. And I don't have the pressure of being a head coach and under the microscope of the American fans. And I think that the last few years, I've been in a position that I kind of find luxurious to be able to focus on me, because I'm just working my way up the ranks and I'm just fighting for a spot on the roster. So I've been able to focus on me and getting better as an individual. And that will shift a lot this year. And now it'll be a lot more focus on the team and focus on the performance and the results. And I think as we get into the World Cup, the pressure will build because we're no longer in that position of luxury to just worry about fighting for our own spot and just worrying about developing as an individual player. Now it's all going to be about the group. And of course, there's high expectations on us, but I think that, if anything, we put the expectation on ourselves more than anybody else.
Might sound like an odd question, but towards the end of last year, Germany displaced the US as the number one ranked team in the world for the first time in quite a few years. Is that a benefit going into this World Cup? You don't have that pressure of being the number one ranked team. Obviously, Germany now will have that tag. Does it almost give you more motivation knowing that you want to try and reclaim that number one spot as well as try and win a World Cup?
Absolutely. I think I've heard a lot of my teammates say, you know, they can have that. They can be the number one team before the tournament because what matters is who's the number one team after the tournament. But then at the same time, as I said, I think that no matter what the world ranking says, our team has our own expectations for ourselves, and that's what rules us. That's what pushes us every day. And I don't think it would really make a big impact psychologically on us either way, because our expectation is to go into that tournament and to win.
We mentioned it earlier. This is the first major tournament that you will have an opportunity to be selected for. I found it incredible when I was doing my research that you obviously didn't play in the World Cup or the Olympics. How important is this year for Kristen Press, the footballer, knowing that that is a massive opportunity for you? And how much are you looking forward to it?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say in January of the year how big is the year going to be for you. I think it's a question I'll be able to answer only in December. But I'm really excited for this opportunity. I feel like I'm in a good place physically, emotionally, and also just with this team and how we're developing and growing and my role in it. I think that there's an enormous opportunity for me, and I feel like most of my life I've been fighting and learning to put myself in the position that I am now. And we have 5 months of work left as a team, as individuals, and I have no doubt in my mind that I will do everything that I can to be as prepared for this World Cup as is possible. And then it's just about having fun. It's about enjoying the moment and this incredible experience and seeing how far all the work and all the dedication of a lifetime can take you.
Well, we heard Jill Ellis's reaction to the World Cup draw that took place before Christmas. You were put, as what a lot of people are describing, the group of death alongside Sweden, Nigeria and Australia.
Yes.
What was the player reaction to that? Because it's a very interesting one. Obviously, you'll come up against your former coach, Pierre Sundhage, the African champions, Nigeria and Australia, some people's dark horses. It's going to be an exciting group for people to watch as a neutral. What was the player reaction when the draw came out?
I think my favorite reaction was just bring it on. And as I said, we go into this tournament expecting to win it. So I think part of us thinks, you know, this is a group of death because we're in it. You know, no matter who the opponent is, it doesn't change anything. We have to bring our A game. There's not going to be an easy game in this World Cup for us. And that's great. And that will prepare us for the later rounds. There will be no shocking quarterfinals because we'll play worthy opponents from the get-go. And I think that it makes it more real. It makes it more exciting to know the dates, to know the stadiums, to know the opponents. And the player reaction was a lot of energy and a lot of excitement.
And you'll no doubt come up against some players that you will have faced in the Damallsvenskan as well. So no doubt, if selected, the players will be looking for you for a little bit of insight, Kristen.
Yeah, I think that we have a huge connection with Sweden. With Tony here now, with Pia here before, and having 6 players, I think, in camp right now that once played in Sweden, with a ton of the Swedish national team players. So we'll have a really close connection there. And also with Australia, with having played for Tom and a lot of the Australian players in the NWSL, I think that both of those teams have a special connection to the US, and I think that that will just build the excitement and the rivalry.
Well, before that, you're obviously in camp at the moment, preparing for 2 quite big international friendlies in February, one of them away in France, but being based in the UK and being a British media outlet, we're obviously particularly interested in the game that you've got against England. How much are you looking forward to that one, coming over and taking on Mark Sampson's side?
I think it, as far as preparation goes, our trip to Europe is one of the ones I'm looking most forward to. Obviously, 2 top ranked World Cup opponents, and playing in an away environment, it will be a really big test for us to see where we are, and also to get those real vicious away settings to prepare us for a World Cup in Canada. I think it'll be a tremendous experience and a tremendous opportunity for us to grow as a team.
And I guess you don't really get huge opportunities to play away from home, do you? And most of your games are played on home soil. I know you had your tournament down in Brasilia just before Christmas, but an opportunity to almost get away from the home support and put yourself in that environment that you're going to have similar to Canada, where quite a lot of the support, regardless of who you're playing, are going to be against you.
Exactly. And I think that's especially true when we go to Europe, because they can get a good crowd and a good support for the other team. And so it makes it an even more intense away experience.
We look forward to welcoming you, Kristen. Obviously, the game has been confirmed now to be played at the Milton Keynes Stadium, which is about 45 minutes to an hour north of London. So we'll see you in a few weeks' time. I would like to thank you for doing this interview at short notice. So I do appreciate it. And I wish you well for the rest of the camp. And we will no doubt speak to you when you're over here in England in a few weeks' time.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Women's Soccer Zone. Listen to the show on Audioboom or download via iTunes. Just search for Women's Soccer Zone.
So big thanks there to Kristen, a player who, if picked, will no doubt have a successful World Cup and a big year in store for her, without question. So that brings us nicely to the end of the show. And I would like to once again thank Kristen for her time. And of course, to Rachel Brown-Finnis for giving up her time to speak about her retirement. Much appreciated as well to JJ Duke for giving us such a comprehensive